This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 1st, 2021. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting again today from Phoenix. We're going to talk to you about some things that have gone on this week in the area of taxes and related developments. First thing I'm going to talk about is that there was a late revision to the PPP loan program. As you're aware, we have this short-term reopening that started in effectively early January, going to end at the end of what's now going to be this month. If you're listening to this on Monday, because this is a March 1st edition, and we're going to, by the end of the month, be out of this. Well, we have a couple of changes being made here toward the end of the program, and we'll talk a little bit about what they are. As it stands right now, we do not have the formal guidance on it, which, of course, is causing some stress because it was announced early in the week, and we've gotten to the end of the week without formal guidance being issued, but we'll talk about where we're at. We also had, early on Saturday morning, the House passed a COVID-19 relief bill. Basically passing the third major bill, I guess, third, fourth, depends on how you're counting. If you count the first one that came in with the credit for the payroll taxes and mandatory sick leave, then I guess this would be the fourth bill. If you're only considering the CARES Act and later, I guess this is kind of the third bill. But in any event, we have that bill in process and now moving to the Senate, and we'll discuss what's in that bill as well as maybe its odds of making it through the Senate with what kind of changes. We're going to talk about a court case that's just kind of interesting and amusing, about a taxpayer who got out of paying tax on $300,000 worth of credit card rewards the taxpayer received, and we'll talk about why that was not taxable income to the taxpayer. And we'll also talk about the fact that those who reside in Texas, who went through the winter storm problem, and then the electrical grid problem, and then the water pipe problem, yeah, they went through a few problems. Those Texans in general are going to get an extension until June 15th to file their tax returns. So we'll talk about how all that's going to go. The rest of us, we'll talk a little bit about where the rest of us stand at this point. But for the rest of us, it's pretty much right now, nope, we're not hearing anything currently. So let's get started and talk about an announcement that came out of the White House, a fact sheet on February the 22nd. Announcing changes that were going to be made to the PPP loan program. And what the White House told us was there were a number of changes they wanted to make to the program. And a couple of them are going to be significant for our clients. The one that's gotten the most press, although the fact sheet doesn't actually tell us what's going to happen here, but we're assuming, based on what has been told and what various parties have heard from the White House, and just the fact that we're guessing what they're basing this on, that there's going to be an expansion of the amount of loan that a sole proprietor or self-employed person could receive, and that that amount of loan will be based not on the net income of the sole proprietor or the self-employed person, but rather will be based on gross income. Now, that part, it's based on gross income, is not really stated anywhere in the fact sheet. We just know it'll be a greater amount than they're currently qualifying for. However, if you recall, in the year-end bill that was part of the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, we got a special provision for self-employed farmers. And if you remember that provision, it allowed the farmer to use his gross revenue rather than the net on Schedule F as the basis for the income replacement for the farmer. It appears everything we're hearing currently is that essentially we're going to take that Schedule F program and map it onto Schedule C. So instead of taking your net income, you're going to take your gross income. So if your proprietorship has significant expenses, you know, it's not going to do you a whole lot of, it's going to do you some, but not a huge amount of good. If, let's say, you're a one-person CPA firm, yeah, you have some expenses, but, you know, your major expense is the personnel and you're it, if you're the only person there. So that probably won't be a huge benefit there. But if you are, let's say, running a trucking company as a sole proprietor, don't know how many of those there are, but I'm sure there's some. That would be very, very different because a lot of expenses go into that. It's very equipment intensive. So in that case, you could find significant depreciation, significant lack of income, and suddenly you'd be able to boost that number. Now, the problem is, of course, that right now they're still saying sole proprietor, self-employed. That's not going to do you any good if you're an S corporation, because then we're going back to the owner's salary as being what we're looking at here, the wages, etc. But this is coming up. The other thing that's not very clear, but it appears that if you've already applied for and received your loans, you're not going to be allowed to go back and get the increase. So it's one of those things that a lot of banks have advised sole proprietors to put their loans on hold. Now, that hopefully doesn't backfire. By that, I mean, we are running into the final month of the program now. Depending how long it takes this SBA to get this guidance out and how backed up the banks get with processing loans, we could be seeing a repeat of what we saw in the original PPP loan program, but then it was running out of money was the problem, not running out of time on the program. But you could find it that the banks may start telling people, well, there's no way we can't process your application because we'll never get to it before March 31st. So you need to go somewhere else. So it's kind of an odd decision to make. Right now, I'm not as worried about it. I would be worried about that decision if we got further along and you discover the banks are not keeping up. That's the issue. The other quirk that came in was that they wanted to reserve 2 weeks at this point, pretty late in the program, but they wanted to reserve 2 weeks where it's going to be devoted to small companies, 20 employees or less. The sole proprietors would be in that mix as well, as long as they have a ton of employees. They are the ones applying for the loans right now. So we're also in that 14-day hold period. So if you have more than 20 employees, you're not going to get your loan here in the next 2 weeks or so, is what they're saying. Essentially, if you haven't applied already, your application is going in after this hold period's over. And again, we get concerned because we're not seeing any extension of the program. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the proposed bill, but I'll give you the hint right now. The proposed bill does not extend the PPP loan program past March 31st. Now, whether we'll see an extension anyway, whether we'll see that go, maybe they're gambling that that's the sort of thing they get a bipartisan bill through, and that could allow them to get some other items that maybe are not appropriate for the reconciliation bill. I'm not sure how that goes. There's always the fun of the game of politics and how it's played, but be aware, nothing so far is pushing that back. We are still waiting for all of the details on this SBA program, for the SBA to give us new details. Now, knowing the way the SBA works, they'll probably release it on Sunday. And so it may very well be out by the time you listen to this, because they've been known to release things on weekends and even Sundays that they've been known to release things. So, but we're still looking currently for that. And remember, the whole program is still set to expire. We are now essentially in the final month of the program. So everything is done. If your client is looking for a PPP loan or a PPP2 loan, right? Either one of the loans, the first draw, second draw, remember, we are now running up on the end of the quarter. That may approach you rapidly, more rapidly than you might have expected, because you might have been used to the first program where it really went on for quite a while. You know, we got it in March. Everybody was scrambling anyway. It got extended, so we're able to go all the way through August. And it also, nicely for us who are CPAs, it straddled tax season. So you could actually have finished tax season, and then tax season got delayed. So we were able to be of more assistance. This year, because it came in January just before tax season started, and because it's not going to go beyond the end of tax season, the traditional standard day end. In fact, it'll end 2 weeks earlier. It's going to be more interesting in terms of clients if they need assistance or if they need help with the loan program. There's going to be a super crunch with tax season versus the assistance clients may want on PPP loans. Just kind of keep that stuff in mind because, yeah, it's getting a little interesting. Also going on this week in Washington, Saturday morning, by a vote, I believe it passed by 7 votes, we had the House pass the American Rescue Plan of 2021. So passed on Saturday morning in the House, The Journal of Accounts, you have, it's a couple of really well-written, relatively short articles I'd suggest you read, one of which deals with the tax provisions in the bill, and the other part deals with other business-related, or mainly small business-related provisions that are in the bill and other items that are found there. And this bill right now, it's part of the reconciliation package. It is divided into both tax provisions and non-tax provisions. Now, there is one thing in the bill that's gotten a lot of coverage that's not likely to be in the Senate bill. Let me briefly discuss, or at least it's going to have to change in nature drastically. Part of the House bill includes a program that would eventually raise minimum wage at the federal level to $15 an hour. Right, currently, it's down at, I think, $7.25 an hour. Arizona has a higher minimum than that. A number of other states do as well. So, you know, whatever that might be, but it would raise the federal number to $15 per hour. Now, why that won't be in the Senate bill first, there was a problem anyway, whether it could get through the Senate. We'll have to talk about the reconciliation process and how it works. But the other catch was that a reconciliation bill, and the reason why that's important is it is a bill that cannot be stopped by 41 senators. Normally, 41 senators can stop any bill because you need 60 votes in order for the Senate to agree to bring a bill to a vote. So if 41 senators oppose, while that's far short of a majority of the Senate, that is enough to stop the Senate from ever voting on a bill. And that normally takes place for most bills. You have to get the 60 votes to end debate and be able to go to the vote. So now we're going to work under this special rule, which is the reconciliation process. In the reconciliation process, we don't have that rule. In essence, a simple majority brings it to the floor. Obviously, a simple majority brings it to a vote, and a simple majority is all that's needed to pass it. So as long as over half the Senate, or in this case, 50 of the senators plus the vice president, are in favor of the bill, that's enough to get a reconciliation bill through. Now, reconciliation bills go back to the budget process years ago, but we've used them creatively in recent years, not necessarily for pure budget issues. For those who don't recall, you go all the way back to AGTRA was a reconciliation bill. That was George W. Bush's first tax bill back in 2001 when he came into office. We also had reconciliation was used to pass the Affordable Care Act in 2009, right? New president, new bill. We tried to use reconciliation to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and that crashed and burned badly. But again, new president, you try a new reconciliation option, right, to get through. And now we're going to be trying reconciliation, and we did use reconciliation in the second year of the president's term, of, you know, President Trump's term, to get through the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So yes, it was used then. And what's happened over time is it's moved to, while the original AGTRA bill did get some Democratic votes, the ones since then that I referred you to, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the ACA, and almost certainly this bill we're going to see today, have all been passed on pure straight party line votes. So reconciliation bills have been effectively used, subject to their weird rules, to allow the party that gets control of all three levers of power, the White House, control of the House, control of the Senate, to get one priority bill through a year, basically every year. And since in theory, if there's no changes in membership, nobody dies in office and is replaced, and there's a party switch or other issues, then that means that you normally get two tries. And as I say, the last time the Republicans were going to go for two tries, the idea was repeal the ACA and then get the tax bill through. They were going to double up, and obviously it failed. The big danger is because there is no room in this, and today, with the Democratic majority in the Senate being a razor thin majority, it is as small a majority as you can get, an evenly divided Senate with the vice president providing the majority vote. Basically, you can't lose a single vote because setting up a reconciliation bill now, it's almost given that the opposition party will vote no. Everybody there will hold together on a no vote. I don't think we'll even see some of the usual suspects that might cross over are not likely to on this vote. So now they can't lose a vote. Okay. So what does that have to do with minimum wage? Well, the minimum wage provision has been ruled by the Senate parliamentarian to not really be germane to the budget process. And I think a lot of people figured that'd be the case. In fact, it was reported that the president had even told senators that, yeah, that's not going to be in the bill. You know, I think one of the issues is, you know, President Biden, who had been in the Senate for a long time, I suspect he thought it'd be a real stretch to try to figure out how this fit the reconciliation process. You know, and it would be really difficult to make it go. So he's just saying, yeah, it's not going to be there. But there is now a proposal being floated, so be aware of this. You may hear about it, that, okay, we have to take that out of the bill. In theory, the vice president could override the parliamentarian's decision. But it is nobody expects the Vice President Harris to override that decision. That would be taking the whole nuclear option one step further. So everybody thinks that she's going to back off. She's not going to override the parliamentarian. And she, remember, the vice president technically is the presiding officer of the Senate. It's a historical background. That's who runs the Senate. So as long as the vice president's there, which usually the problem is the vice president, if it's not evenly divided, doesn't really care. They only get to vote if it's a dead even heat. So they're normally not there unless we expect a close vote. And then they show up to run the Senate. But in this case, for reconciliation, she's going to have to be there for everything just to get it to go through. So the idea is she won't override. So what's being proposed now is there would be a tax imposed on larger businesses, and we need to get the definition of larger and smaller, that failed to raise their minimum wage above $15 an hour. It would be imposed on all wages paid. And the flip side of it, there would be some sort of tax credit offered to employers that raise their minimum wages, that are small employers, that raise their minimums above $15 an hour. So, yeah, we'll have to see what that proposal is. That may surface. It's rumored that Senator Wyden, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee, it's a pet project of his, to use this kind of tax. And the idea is this tax would be germane to the subject, because it's a tax provision, right? It's a tax provision, tax credit provision. They're germane, just like all the TCJA provisions that were tax credit provisions, right? Or tax deduction provisions. Those are all considered germane issues. So they're there. Okay. So aside from that, what else is in this bill? Well, with tax provisions, the big one that everybody was going to talk about, because it got all the coverage up front, is we're going to get another set of advanced payments of recovery rebates. Now, this time it does appear it'll be a 2021 credit. So you don't worry about it messing up your 2020 returns already, right? They're not going to go back and undo that. However, what the bill would do is provide a $1,400 base. And $1,400 would go to a single individual, would get a $1,400 recovery rebate. We'll talk about the phase outs here in a second. Married couple would get $2,800, but you'd also get $1,400 for every dependent, right? It would no longer say dependent is limited to those who are a qualifying child. So we would get up that. So that could get you up there. And the phase outs would apparently still be the way it was under the original bill. So what we have in terms of phase outs would be the same rules we had before, where we begin phasing out at $75,000 of gross income, $150,000 in married filing joint. You would phase out based upon your dollars over that. If you remember before, we phased out at $24,000 above 75 because that was at the 5% level. It would take you, given it was a $1,200 credit, it would totally phase out at $24,000. Obviously, now we're going to go to $1,400. So that's going to take us from, in this case, the old $2,400 up to $24,000 to $28,000. So now you'll be looking at that on top of the $75,000. you'd be looking at $103,000 of AGI would be your test. Now, the catch is it will be based on the 2019 return, unless the 2020 return has already been filed, and we'd have to say processed by the IRS. If you do it on paper, that's probably still trying to get to your 19 return. We'll ignore that problem temporarily. It would be paid out in advance as before, and again, you'd reconcile it on the 21 return, right? That would be the key. Now, they're also going to add a special rule for a COBRA continuation coverage credit. And this one's kind of interesting. It'd be a payroll tax credit. They like payroll tax credits. To the company that you pay the COBRA payment to, but it would give them a tax credit equal to the amount they reduced the premium for the people paying COBRA coverage who got laid off, etc. So the idea is to be routed through the program. There'd be penalties for not informing people that they're no longer eligible, etc. There'd be all kinds of little rules like that. But it would be another payroll tax credit. The 941 would get more complicated yet again. That's part of the deal. We also would have a refundable and advanceable child tax credit. The child tax credit would grow up to potentially $3,000. Now, again, it will phase out earlier than the main credit, the increase, but it'd be $3,000 per child. It would be refundable, and we would go ahead and allow the 17-year-olds to be qualifying children for this purpose. So we would no longer stop at 16, so it would go to 17 temporarily. It would also be beginning in July, the IRS would begin paying parents 1/12 of what they think they would qualify for. Now, you're going to still have to true that up on the 2021 return. And if it turns out you got paid more than you ultimately qualified for, you would have to pay that back. There's a bit of protection for certain taxpayers who have incomes at $120,000 or below would be the catch. It has a $60,000 or below, you would get the full benefit of the protection. It would phase out up to $120,000, I think, or let's see. I guess it would begin at $120,000. It's a little strange, but we'll get some sort of protection in that range for this credit. And again, that's the monthly check you've been hearing about for children. That would be coming up beginning in July, again, based on probably the 2019 return again. Okay. We'd also have expansion of the earned income tax credit, make it liberalized and make it a bit easier to work with. It would greatly increase the amount of the investment income you could have to get the EITC for this year. So things like that to pump it up, allow you to use 2019 or instead of 2020 or 2021 for your testing, if that would help you, because that'll help some for earned income credit. We also have additional changes coming in. The Child Independent Care Credit, in this case, would be refundable and potentially increased. So we could get that for Child Dependent Care. We would also get an extension through the end of September of the credit for family and sick leave, and an extension through the end of the year for the Employee Retention Credit. Now, that last part would complicate it if you've been planning to maximize your ERC by just saying, well, look, the ERC is only good for the first two quarters, and we have some covered period for our PPP loan if we get it late enough after that date. And if that was key to your maximization strategy, you might have to rethink it, because the ERC now is going to continue beyond that point. So now things will get messier on your maximization. We will expand and liberalize the premium tax credit, make it available to more people who are getting their coverage through the exchanges, that more of them will qualify for a credit for this year. And we're going to repeal Section 864H. For those who don't know what that is right off, which I suppose will be most of you, it allowed affiliated groups to allocate interest on a worldwide basis. That would be a permanent revocation. As I recall that, that'll be most of this is 1 year only, kind of like the CARES Act, but that'd be a permanent issue. Among the non-tax provisions, we have an expansion of funding. In certain areas, we would have a $350 billion going to state, local, and tribal governments, $130 billion going to elementary and high schools, $40 billion to college and universities, and $75 billion for COVID-19 testing and support of the vaccine rollout program. We'd also have a number of things to support small businesses. $15 billion for certain targeted economic injured disaster loan advance payments. These are for people in certain disadvantaged areas to get EIDL advances, like the original ones that were open to everybody. We're not going to have a special more. We're going to have an expanded, more targeted version. We got a first targeted version in the act at the end of the year. We'd get a second expanded version here, another $15 billion. A special $25 billion program to give grants to restaurants, bars, and other providers of food and drink, to help them out who've had lost this. We would have $1.25 billion additional going to the Shuttered Venue Operators Program to give grants there, and $175 million to create a Community Navigator Pilot Program to help get people through these things. So see how that would go. The other thing is the PPP loan program. Interestingly enough, they give it a little bit of additional funding. I mean, think about $7.25 billion is a little bit these days, but given the numbers in the program, that's a little bit of additional funding. And they expand the not-for-profits that can cover here, getting other 501Cs aside from the 501Cs currently qualified, and allowing certain larger not-for-profits to qualify for the loans. But in all of these cases, we are not pushing the date past March 31st. So the program still ends at the same time. Now, as I said, let's talk about the Senate here for just a second. What's the chance this bill goes through the Senate? Well, there's no chance unchanged unless my Vice President Harris does the totally unexpected and overrides the parliamentarian, which probably would be a futile effort anyway, because bottom line, you know, I don't know that they have all 50 votes lined up for that anyway. So the odds are that that would probably not go through. Will we get the tax? That also comes into question. You know, will that be considered palatable to those Democrats who might not have wanted to do the $15 per hour minimum wage? Not sure. Obviously, you know, I figure those that were in favor of the $15 per hour minimum wage are not going to have problems passing that tax provision. Those who might have thought that could put them at risk may have trouble passing it, voting for it in the tax variant as well. So we'd have to keep an eye on that. But bottom line, we know, therefore, the Senate bill has to be different from the House because the House did not strip out the minimum wage provision. So we know we have to go to conference. We also know that in conference, they would have to resolve the differences. And obviously, the minimum wage provision has to come out, which makes it kind of interesting that it didn't come out in the House initially. My guess is it's so all the Democrats in the House could be on the record of voting for it. That's my guess as to why we did it. So anyway, we've got that. My guess is the goal for this thing is to get it passed by March 14th, because that's when the money runs out for the unemployment. The additional $300 per week unemployment payment would run out on March 14th. This bill would extend that. That's rumored to be the date they want to see this pass by. That would mean we'd see Senate action here sometime soon. We'd see reconciliation. So they got about 2 weeks. So that means we may very well be staring down the barrel of this new tax bill right at March 15th, which is probably the worst possible date to get a brand new tax bill that clients want to have everything explained to them. Also remember, because of that 2019 or 2020 return option for the potential for the payment of the recovery rebate, your clients may want their returns accelerated. Some whose income was down in 2020 will want the returns accelerated. Those whose income went up in 2020 will want to slow up their returns. This ought to be very interesting. So just keep that in mind, that's all potentially coming at you in about 2 weeks. Okay, let's go to what I thought was one of the more interesting cases I've seen in a long time. This is the Anarchy versus Commissioner case. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2021-23. This one came out on February 23rd. And interestingly enough, Constantine Anarchive and his spouse had a Blue Cash American Express credit card. And that became important because American Express started a rewards program that, to put it mildly, the couple figured out how to game very well. Okay? What they found out was that you could get reward, dollar back rewards, essentially, effectively, or credit back rewards, dollar for, you know, on purchases of gift cards because they were considered products. You couldn't get it on pure cash advances, but you could on purchases of gift cards. And what they discovered was that the gift card could not itself be converted directly to cash. You can't do that. If I buy, let's say, a Visa gift card, you know, to give to somebody as a present, they can't just go get that in cash, right? That's, you know, the whole point of it is to keep it on the card because then they might not spend it all. And then, you know, somebody gets to make money off doing that. So it works out well. So in any event, you know, they have to buy the gift card. But they discovered they could use the gift card to buy money orders because there are places that would take the gift card in exchange for money orders to purchase for the purchase of money orders. And what they discovered was the fees that were being charged to get the money orders were less than the reward. So, you know, hey, guess what? You know, you can play that nice little spread and you make a lot of money. Now, he ran a lot of charges through his American Express card at a $35,000 limit, but he was running millions through this thing. He ended up qualifying net for $300,000 of credit card reward benefits over about the year period that he did this. Some benefits, he started doing it in, it appears, late 2013. The major part of this took on in 14. Now, that's all well and good. So he was getting, and he literally got $300,000 he could effectively pocket out of this transaction. So as I said, he bought the gift cards, he converted the money orders, he paid back the credit cards, and then rinse and repeat. You do it again now. You got room on the credit card, you buy more gift cards, you buy more money orders, you deposit them in the bank, you pay off the credit card, and you just rotate through that as fast as you can. And they were doing a pretty good job rotating through it. But as I said, he ended up pocketing $300,000. Now, the IRS got word of this, and the IRS was in kind of a quandary, which the court tells us about. Back in 1979, the IRS issued a revenue ruling, and that revenue ruling in 1979 dealt with what then was a relatively new phenomenon. 1979, you know, things were kind of, the economy was in the doldrums, or I should say 76, right? In that range. So the economy was in the doldrums at the time. Yeah, 76. The economy was a bit in the doldrums. And so the car companies at that point decided that in order to try to move inventory, they would go ahead and pay rebates directly to customers. That way they could clear out the dealer's inventory without having to basically pay money back to dealers or buy back vehicles. And that would be the structure. And the question becomes, well, if I go and I buy a car and then I'm given $600 as a rebate, is that $600 income? Well, in Revenue Ruling 7696, the IRS ruled, and this becomes the key start of all of this, that $600 was not income, but rather was a reduction of the purchase price of the car. So, okay, that ruling is the only real thing we have directly on point. However, other programs started ramping up. And we all know, and you probably all have seen, right, credit card programs, right, where if you have, let's say, an Amazon Prime Visa, you know, you get 5% of all Amazon purchases, get you like a dollar for dollar credit that you then can spend to buy, more stuff. You know, other credit cards have had that too. There's lots of these cash back credit card issues that do that or give you at least cash credit on the credit card so you could then use the reward points to buy whatever. Well, the IRS ruled generally those. They said, well, that old ruling kind of covers that. Because really, you know, if I go to Amazon and I buy, you know, a computer monitor and Amazon gives me 5% of the cost of that monitor back because I use my Amazon Visa, well, then really, instead of paying $100 for that monitor, I paid $95. So my basis in the monitor would become $95. Okay, that's great. Nothing happens. And then on the other side, you had things like, and definitely seen this happen, you know, Chase does this quite often, sends out mailers, you know, if you open a brand new account, you deposit certain minimum amounts, that Chase will help you, you know, and put $50, $100, $150 in the account. Well, in that case, that's considered taxable income because you got cash directly. And it wasn't exactly, there's nothing there to reduce basis of, really, is one of the issues that the service would have seen. They said, well, that's cash, that counts. So now we get to good old Constantine's issue here. You know, what did he do? Well, the IRS said, look, the whole purpose of this is him to get cash. So he's getting cash effectively by doing this. When he does this, it's all structured to get cash. Well, now the IRS, interestingly enough, said, therefore, they're saying the gift cards were not a product. So even though, you know, they said normally they are, because normally if I buy a $100 gift card that I'm going to give as a gift, right, and I get a 5% discount on that, well, it reduces the basis in the gift card, the gift. And even if I keep the gift card and I go and spend it at a restaurant, well, it just reduced the cost of the meal, right, by getting that rebate. So, you know, that's not a problem. They said, but in this case, because he was going to go out and buy the money orders, that should be taxable income. Well, the tax court actually didn't buy it. The tax court said, no, the gift cards are, you know, are proper. You even told us they're basically a product, right? You allow that they're a product in other context. You're saying his intention to go get the money order is what kills this. And they're saying, we don't think that's the case. IRS, you could reduce the basis of the card. Now, interestingly enough, the IRS never argues that the card, so let's say, you know, I buy a $1,000 card and I get 5% back. So my $1,000 card, I've got $50 back. Well, they never argue that when I then go use that gift card to buy $1,000 worth of money orders, right, to get the $1,000 worth of money orders out of the issue, that was a sale of the gift card for a $50 gain. IRS didn't argue that. My guess is there are probably other facts we don't know here, which could also mean that Constantine has a big capital loss carryover. So the IRS was not going to be able to tax everything, because otherwise it would normally be like short-term capital gain. You're probably not going to hold the gift card for a year. So it'd be a short-term gain. And, you know, we would then be able to tax it at that point. Didn't argue that. They argued the cash. The tax court said, hey, this is flat out, you know, you have the program. You've decided to issue guidance, you know, kind of piecemeal, and go to court and try to define things in some cases. The court said, clearly, we wouldn't even be here. And you wouldn't even be thinking of raising this issue if the numbers weren't the size they were. So you're not saying generically that all of these are taxable. The court said, IRS, you can have it one of two ways. Either this is always taxable, and so everybody would have to pay tax on these reward programs, or you're going to have to say that it's not. And, you know, or at least on gift cards, you'd have to say if you buy gift cards with a rewards credit card, you should have to pay tax on that value or not. You can't look through the purchase. So they're saying, and if you don't want to do that, you should actually issue regulations or real guidance, which is the thing I love to hear the court say, because the IRS is being very much into this whole informal guidance, and we're going to put things in instructions, we're going to put up FAQs on the website, we're going to do everything possible to avoid giving guidance that actually has some level of formality to it. And, you know, the court said, IRS, you know, you made this problem, it's yours. So the taxpayer, interestingly enough, gamed American Express's system enough to get $300,000 from them, and they're probably not unhappy because they got the credit card processing fees, you know, and all these things. In essence, when you think about how the money came to him, it actually is just kind of a cut of the fees American Express is going to make off the sales. And, you know, you kind of follow out where the money comes from. You're going to see, you know, they're just spread all over the place because it's using credit card fees, and him getting a cut of them is what's really happening in all these transactions. So it was kind of interesting, but American Express did not object. And the court, it did say, you know, the few times he went out and just directly bought money orders with his American Express Blue card and earned his rewards there, that was taxable. Said in that case, yes, he directly got a cash equivalent. That's taxable, but the gift cards are not cash equivalents. Or as the court said, if they're cash equivalents, everybody has to pay tax whenever they buy a gift card with a reward credit card. And if they're not cash equivalents, then this guy doesn't either. Your problem, IRS, is you got to go for the sale or exchange to do it. As a practical matter, will this make a big difference? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. You know, like I said, anybody who thought, first thing is, if you find a program like this, I guess I wouldn't mind too much if I paid tax on $300,000. You know, if I'm going to get that much, I would say I'd prefer not to, but I'd still probably consider doing it if it was taxable. But the flip side of it is, obviously, if you don't have a large capital loss carryover, the obvious IRS solution to this is to go for the short-term capital gain. So be aware of that. Finally, let's close out with a news release, IR 2021-43, that came out on the 22nd. And what happened in this case was the IRS wanted to deal with the winter storm that hit Texas. And as I said earlier, you know, then create a major problem on the electricity grid. Kind of brought it to its knees. Then went ahead and also had problems with water mains, you know, water pipes freezing. You couldn't get water. It was water plants shut down. It's like all kinds of mess went on. Okay, because of all of that, the IRS is now under 7508 Cap A, remember it from last year, has now extended the tax events generally. So for filing returns, we're pretty much getting pushed back to June 15th as the deadline, not July. So didn't like do last year of kicking it back three months from April 15th, but they're kicking it back at this point to June 15th. So any tax returns that are due on March 15th or April 15th, if the taxpayer lives in Texas, and right now this is the state of Texas, plus any other areas around Texas that get named by FEMA as disaster areas. I think there are some in Louisiana that got named and some other areas, but for the most part, this is Texas. You know, they'll be able to file their returns on March 15th, and April 15th returns will be on June 15th. And they noted that the due date for IRA contributions for those that live in Texas will be pushed back to June 15th, not April 15th. The IRS will generally, okay, will also going to have payroll tax and excise tax deposits. Those that are due on or after February 11th, when this started, as long as they end up being paid by yesterday, they're timely and there won't be a penalty. So they gave them until that day to get payroll tax deposits done. They did also note in the news release, and they say this most times like this, they will try to automatically identify taxpayers who live in the affected area. In this case, relatively simple, Texas. That's easier than some of the others have been. If the taxpayer lives in the affected area, the IRS will automatically provide these rules on them. They do state if you get a notice, even though you are affected, or let's say you live outside the area, but the books and records are inside the area, there are various other ways this expands. They tell you how to contact them and deal with this. Assuming somebody answers the phone, you could deal with this relief. But this relief would apply in those cases as well. Where do we sit on generic relief? Glad you asked. The commissioner this week in testimony before the House Subcommittee on IRS Oversight essentially stated that there is no current plan to extend the due date past March 15th. The commissioner also stated that, you know, he didn't plan to do that. It puts the IRS way behind. They don't see a need to do it. If they delay it, things stack up for the IRS as well. And that's why they're so far behind at this point, et cetera. There is still that group of congressmen that called for it to be pushed back. And the commissioner did give a bit and say, yes, he's heard all the people asking for a pushback. And they're keeping track of things. But they did not commit. Now, unless something comes out here real soon, I think we can pretty much dismiss the AICPA's call to let us know by March 1st, one way or the other. I doubt that. Yeah, we're not going to get that clear guidance by March 1st. So are we going to get an extension of the April 15th date? Don't know. I don't think the commissioner wants to do it. Will he do it anyway? Not sure. I think we'll just have to watch and see what happens. I suspect there will be pressure to do it. We'll see how far that goes. It may also be, if we do get this new bill and the IRS has to process checks as well and make more changes to the systems, that also could have an impact on it. Although it appears the new bill is not going to make retroactive changes, at least for the most part, to 2020 law and 2020 returns. So it may be that the IRS will just say, well, if we get checks out, and that we pretty much already have written, we just got to change to 1400. If we can handle that part, then they may still think they can get the deadline on April 15th. So I certainly am telling any client right now to assume April 15th is your deadline. Don't go out here and assume that we're going to have until July this year. I've been asked a couple of times. My line is, until somebody says for sure, it's April 15th, and you know, if you sat here and plan it'll be July, I guarantee you it won't be. And secondly, even the AICPA this year said they thought if you're going to push it back, you push it back to June. Don't necessarily go all the way to July. So we'll have to see what happens there. Well, this has been In Tax Season. One more time, our first week in our first show, our first basic program here of March. So we're into March, the third month of the year. And obviously, peak tax season is the way I look at March. The first big due dates come up, and people are getting their paperwork. And I don't know about you, but I know the number of returns in our office has gone dramatically up in the past week versus the clients that had turned things in before that. So things ramp up rapidly. So again, this is the fun part of the year. We'll keep an eye on that bill, see what the Senate's doing. If we get a final bill, I got to try to figure out how to find some time to actually analyze it and get out whatever may happen there. The good news is there aren't a ton of tax provisions in the bill. They're relatively focused, and I think it'll be relatively straightforward. And a lot of them are aimed at lower income individuals that probably aren't going to impact most CPA practices terribly. But we will have others that will impact, so we'll talk some about those. Certainly the payroll tax credit issues, those are going to be big. The ERC, the leave credit, and that COBRA continuation credit, all of those will have big impact on payroll again, so we'd have to keep an eye on that. So keep your eye on here. We'll kind of see what happens. We'll watch what goes on, and we'll come back here next week when we'll talk about more current federal tax developments.